sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. Whatever the virtues of the many fields of knowledge, all are steps on the path to omniscience. May these arise in the clear mirror of intellect. All Manjushri, please accomplish this. Abhidharma. And personally, I found it rather surprising to see how similar it was to Mahayana version of the paths and the stages and the activities and all the different distinctions. And I thought it had brought out some interesting nuances about the way the scheme works, the different types of obscurations, and where along the path they are encountered and overcome, and the role of understanding in that process. And the wonderful ability to use foreign terms that the author has. So let's start on page 179 of our source book. And let's see. Gave you a list of terms that had a lot missing. Maybe we can fill some in. And it didn't have the abbreviations. So starting actually with the page before, in the first line of the chapter, it says the sixth chapter of the AKB. Any guess?
Abhidharma Kosha.
Bingo. Abhidharma Kosha Bingo. That's the B part, right? Abhidharma Kosha Bhasha. Bhasha's commentary. It's a type of commentary in Sanskrit. Word for a type of, you know, they have different types of commentaries. So Bhasha means a general commentary.
How do you spell?
B-H-A-S-H-Y-A, Bhashya. Bhashya. And the Abhidharma Kosha is famous for having been written from two points of view. The root text is from the the commentary is from the Sautrantika, and the root text is from the Vaibhashika point of view. So the commentary addresses some of the incomplete parts of the root text. Anyway, that's a major source for Abhidharma literature, since it was written about 500. Sorry, it was written about 350, 400 in the Common Era. And by that time, a lot of material had already come out and a lot of different theories and trends, and so Vasubandhu was able to condense those and address different streams of thought. So then on the next page, the first full paragraph says, for the Sarvastivada, those who profess that everything exists. Sarva is everything, Asti is exists, and Vada is those who profess, or the speakers, the system. The path of spiritual progress is a very long journey, which is why I've asked you to bring your lunch and a change of underwear. It takes three incalculable kalpas, or aeons, for a practitioner to reach the state of perfect Buddhahood, practicing accumulatively the six perfections. So the same system as the Mahayana. Do you notice the order of the perfections are slightly different? So Shila, discipline is listed first. What is normal?
Generosity.
Generosity is first. And then Virya, exertion, here is listed third. Usually it's listed
fourth.
And patience is usually third, right? Dhyana and Prajna are the same order. And tens of thousands of difficult practices along that time period. This long period of practice pertains, in fact, only to the stage of preparatory effort, pra-yoga. So this reveals that the Sarvastivada point of view is that the Buddha spent most of that three incalculable aeons as a worldly being, an ordinary being. And during the last day of his life as an ordinary being, he progressed through from the preparatory path through the path of seeing and the path of cultivation to the path of no more learning, all in that 12 hours from when he sat down to the dawn when he attained complete perfect Buddhahood. Others feel that that's unrealistic and that he had achieved a higher state of attainment before that particular day. The whole process is one of gradual progress. And the Sarvastivada doctrine is definitely not one of sudden enlightenment. You see later, he's addressing the tension between traditions that believe there's sudden enlightenment versus the mainstream of Buddhism is all about gradual enlightenment. And then he quotes the Buddha, there's nobody in the past, present, or future who can acquire knowledge and vision with regard to all dharmas abruptly. If one says there is, one is speaking of an impossibility. One must first go through three incalculable aeons, practicing tens of thousands of difficult practices, gradually perfecting the paramitas in order that one can possess true knowledge and vision with regard to all dharmas. Knowledge and vision.
What's the MVS?
Oh, thank you. So MVS is Maha, meaning great, and Vibhasha. Vibhasha is a compilation, and Shastra, so the commentary on the Mahavibhasha. And the Mahavibhasha is pretty much the main Abhidharma source material for everything else. It appears like one or 200 years before Vasubandhu, and it just sort of compiles all the other Abhidharma literature that had existed before it, and is not particularly well organized. Well, it's sort of extremely repetitive and long, but it provides enormous source material for which other people then draw upon. Vasubandhu and all sorts of other authors look at that literature as basically the main source for what had developed prior to that time.
So the paramitas, I guess, were originally in the Mahayana.
Yeah, so the difference is that the paramitas and the goal of Buddhahood was viewed as a a goal and and those paramitas as a practice only for one person every world period. So only one person would become a Buddha.
It's very Nietzschean.
And that person would have to go through those three incalculable aeons and the six paramitas.
Like
there was
Highlander.
Only one Buddha at a time. And then there was a big gap. And then the next Buddha would appear. But, you know, in Hinayana, not everybody, only one person can become a Buddha. Other people can only become arhats. So that was one of the revolutionary advancements or changes of the Mahayana. And that, well, everybody can practice the paramitas and ultimately become a Buddha. And they felt that only one person could, that there was every aeon, there was one special person whose job it was to become a Buddha. And nobody else should even try.
But didn't the Buddha talk about paramitas as a practice?
Only in the Mahayana sutras. In the so-called early sutras, he talks about how he did them and what his greatness was. But he doesn't talk about other people doing it until the Mahayana sutras.
So there would be a distinction from their own side of what an arhat's powers are and what the Buddha's powers are?
Yes.
Okay. They sketch all that out?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Not in as much detail as the Mahayana. The Mahayana went into more detail about what those differences were. Because they were interested in showing how much better the Buddha was than they are.
So with the arhats, that's kind of end of the line on the Theravadan side of things. They don't see any further advancement happening.
No, they don't. They see that as an end game.
The Mahayana are saying, no, you guys aren't done yet.
Right.
Nothing is ever done yet.
Right.
Except the final 11th
boom. Mahayanas just want to drag things out forever.
What up to the 11th boom?
Yeah, when's that going to happen?
They got no more learning, too.
And then doesn't Maitreya shoot like a beam of light out of his heart to wake up all the arhats so they can become bodhisattvas and tread the paramitas?
That's what the Mayas say.
Yeah.
When did that happen, by the way?
Waiting for it.
Right. It's like Jesus coming.
Yeah.
Second coming.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're going to wake up all those arhats at some point. It has to be quality.
At the Met, the curators of the Chinese Buddhist iconography, they use words like salvational Buddhism.
Yeah.
That's how they describe some of the Mahayana. They call it salvational, messianic.
Yeah.
Robert Thurman used that term too.
Early on, you know, Trump Rinpoche used salvation early on. He learned, you know, English in England, and there were long Theravadan teachers that he encountered. And, you know, individual salvation. His translation initially for Hinayana.
Liberation.
And then they changed it for individual liberation.
Hmm. Well, salvation implies there's something to save.
That's right. And that there's a salve that does it.
Libation of the salve.
Libation. Drink this and put this on your hands and it'll all be good. Okay, so the next page, preliminaries for the preparatory.
Do you want us to open the window? We turn the AC off. Should we open the window?
I'd prefer that.
What about John here? You're in John.
Yeah, cool.
If he listens, he's going to hear all of
it. I know. We're going to go back.
We love you, John.
John, don't worry. And do you want the fan on?
Let's light some more incense.
Yeah. Okay, so let's dive into some parts of this on the next page, which is 81, 80. Then that map of state is.
The quote. What page?
180. In the absolute sense, the intrinsic nature of Abhidharma can only be the outflow-free faculty of understanding. So, knowledge that's free of outflow. There's this whole system of there's worldlings that have outflows, and there's beyond worldlings, super mundane individuals who no longer have outflows. Outflows have the meaning of emitting defilements, emitting, you know, sort of the implication ranges from emitting impure substances to emitting negative karmic activities of body, speech, and mind. So those flow out of our mind stream, our body, our three gates, negative karmic activities, and build up those propensities for further outflows. Those who have achieved the path of seeing and onward no longer create additional. Well, there's some debate like where the dividing line is between stopping outflows, creation, and sort of using up all the outflows completely. But their way of talking about perfection or progress on the path is in relation to this idea of there being outflows. And their types of nirvana are two. There's nirvana with outflows, where you're still a human and you're still subject to the karma of being of having a human body. And then when you die, after you become enlightened and then you die, you no longer have any outflows. There's no longer any karmic activity going on. There's just your karmic continuum is severed completely, blown out like a candle flame. So then there's understanding that has those two gradations. Understanding that's sort of impure because it has outflows, and so it's not as tainted. Yeah. And then there's knowledge and understanding that's not tainted, that's gone beyond outflows. From this perspective, those which bring about the excellent, and so here we see some of the terminology, outflow-free faculty of understanding in the sentence before, prajna, we know is wisdom, and then it's combined with indriya, which is the faculty of, so the faculty of understanding, prajnendriya, and then those which bring about the excellent, vishishta, supreme, worldly understanding derived from cultivation. So, the more common terms it's helpful to know, the Sanskrit. So, bhavana is cultivation. We have famous text by Kamala Shila called the Bhavana Kramas. Kramas are the stages, and bhavana is cultivation. Often translated as the stages of meditation. But as we've seen, bhavana, as it's used as the term to describe the fourth path, means a little more than meditation. And the term for meditation in Buddhism, by saying bhavana, means a little bit more than just meditation in the way that we think of it. It means sort of training one's mind, body, and speech. Cultivating good qualities, cultivating the roots of virtue. And then we see bhavana mayi prajna. So we know that there's three types of prajna, or three stages of prajna: hearing, contemplating, and meditating. And so this is the third type of prajna. So it's the prajna which comes from mayi, arises from bhavana, contemplation. From this perspective, those which bring about excellent worldly understanding derived from cultivation, prajna from meditation, namely the stages of warmed up summit, receptivities, and the worldly supreme dharma. So those are the four stages of the second path preparation. The term receptiveness is usually translated as patience or acceptance. So here's receptivities. Can also be called Abhidharma on account of their ability to discern the four truths separately. So we'll see the four truths are their ultimate focus for the understanding, for development along the path. Constantly returning to experiencing the four truths in greater and greater depth. Again, from this perspective, those which bring about the excellent understanding derived from reflection, second of the three prajnas, which in Sanskrit is chintamayi. So chinta is derived from chitta, the mind. And so contemplation is a sort of mental activity of minding. Prajna. Namely, contemplation on the impure, mindfulness of breathing, etc. So that list that he just started and said, etc. with, is the usual list of the 40 meditation objects that we went through earlier, and that there's a list of there's a chart up in the source book. Can also be called Abhidharma on account of their ability to discern the aggregates, skandhas, separately, both separately and collectively. Again, from this perspective, those that bring about the excellent understanding derived from listening, shruta maya. So shruta is hearing. So the prajna that arisen from hearing, namely the analysis and establishment of the intrinsic and common characteristics of dharma. So we have two activities, analysis, and then he translates establishment. Usually it's like investigation, exploration. Analysis and investigation, and then intrinsic and common. We say specific characteristics or general characteristics. These are the same terms, the same things that he's talking about, just with different terminology in English, of dharmas, destroying the delusion with regard to entities as existing, destroying the delusion that things exist, the delusion with regard to existent entities and cognitive objects. So an indication that there's sort of two stages in that process, existing entities being sort of belief in the external world as being real, and then cognitive objects as being the sort of mind-only view that, well, the reflections that appear in our mind, whether they're true exist or not. Can also be called Abhidharma on account of the fact that they neither superimpose, so they don't project the activities. He's saying the activities around what he just listed can be called Abhidharma because they result in not superimposing, meaning projecting. We say you're projecting onto bare sense data. You're projecting them as having existence, or projecting them to be permanent or unitary or things of that nature. We project onto our experiences as existing, as if they existed, on the one hand, which is eternalism, and on the other hand, we can deny any existential status at all to appearances, and we can deny them and say, well, there's nothing at all there, and karma doesn't matter. Therefore, karma doesn't matter. I can do whatever I want, and it doesn't matter. And that's nihilism. So those two opposites with regards to the Dharma. And you see that the author is going, the quote is presenting the path in reverse here. going from the later stages to the earlier stages. And then again, from this very perspective, those that bring about the excellent understanding derive from the abode of birth. So a preparatory stage to the three prajnas, an idea that there's lower prajna, prajna of understanding just the way things work in the world. In our tradition now, we have lower prajna and higher prajna. Lower prajna is how does a car work? How do you work a computer? How do you get a goddamn document to print, you know, from Word? How do you reload the toner?
I don't know an app.
And then higher prajna, which would be the three prajnas. And he's saying this can also be called Abhidharma. So it's like saying, what is Abhidharma? Abhidharma is that which describes all the stages of the path, all the different activities and the distinctions, both what one does and what one experiences. All of this is Abhidharma, higher dharma. On account of their ability to operate non-erroneously. So the idea of being able to function. You know, we say dharmas are those, is that which performs a function. So it actually operates, functions in receiving, bearing in mind, pondering, and examining. And here it says the 12th then teaching of the Tripitaka. And traditionally, the Tripitaka, this is not the Nidanas, the Tripitaka is divided up into this list of 12 types of styles of teaching that the Buddha did. He did prose discourse, he did Q&A, he did poetry, he did life stories, he did, you know, they come up with 12 different styles of his teachings. So this, the above explanations are in fact a statement of preparatory stages that lead to the attainment of perfect prajna. And these are Abhidharma in the absolute sense. The stages are as follows. First, we start with studying the Buddha's teaching with a supportive understanding derived from birth. I think just derived from birth is just like normal worldly knowledge that we accumulate since we're born. Studying the Abhidharma, analyzing the characteristics of the dharmas, discriminating dharmas, what's an internal dharma, what's an external dharma, what's a skanda, what's a dhatu, what's an ayatana. Meditations such as contemplation on the impure and mindfulness of breathing, which are the most common basic meditation practices. And then the stages. And so those map out the path of accumulation. And then we get the path of preparation, the four stages. And then the attainment of outflow-free prajna, the final destination, which stretches from the path of seeing to the path of no more learning, includes the path of cultivation. Then he gives a more detailed version of, well, has lists more steps. And then on the next page, 181, he gives a little commentary on that. He talks about this issue of regressing. Regressing is a big issue that comes up in discussing the path. To what sense can people regress? And is there some stage at which we don't regress on the path, where we like achieve some stability of accomplishment or understanding where we don't regress? And if there is regression, can one regress like all the way back or just part of the way back? And you know, so there's this dividing line of mere worldling and superhuman beings. And so does that regression go across those categories or not is one of the big issues for the tradition, because they see enlightened people change, you know, over time, and they might become enlightened and manifest as enlightened in many ways, and then they may do things that don't seem enlightened. How do you explain that? Did they become unenlightened, or did they just regress to a certain point, but not to the mere worldly point? And that's generally their opinion, is that once you become a superhuman being, then you go through the stages of stream entry, once returner, non-returner, and arhat. But, and you can progress in that, in those areas, but you won't become a mere worldly again. What do you think that sounded?
I thought.
Pepper grinder.
Pepper grinder? That's a lot of pepper.
I think it's a
duck. It's a duck grinder pepper.
The phone, like a ringtone. Anyway, you saw that one of the important activities is attending upon the old and the sick.
So how do they reconcile this no regression with the Germans?
Yeah, good question. Yeah.
No regression with what?
No regression with impermanence.
The whole system is described as the whole system of achievement and progress on the path is described not in terms of achieving something, obtaining something that then would be subject to problems such as does it exist, is it permanent or impermanent, but instead cutting off the production of anything negative. And so inherent is that, in that system, is that there isn't a pure basis that's being uncovered, being revealed by process of cutting off the negativity.
So this is where Buddha nature theory arises.
Comes from later, but they don't explain that. They don't conclude that in the early tradition. They don't, you know, emphasize
but,
that.
But,
you know.
But this is where the idea probably germinates.
Totally, it's got to come from that.
They do call
which is the idea of outflows. You know, so there's all this negativity, and gradually you're cutting off the outflows. You're eliminating outflows, as opposed to. You know, they do say you're accumulating the good, the roots of good dharma, kusala dharmas. But it's not like there's some entity in particular that one has that can be subject to impermanence. I'm sorry.
Did it not say in here that nirvana is uncreated? And we've seen that before. But nirvana is uncreated.
Yeah.
So that's a seed right there, as you're saying. But like, it said, like I think it does say that. So that, yeah, somehow... You can't just climb up there and then you fall off.
Right. So nirvana is not permanent or impermanent because it has no entity.
It's merely a reveal or not a reveal.
Yeah. But it is interesting. And it's interesting to see it sort of played out or written about, described in this way, as opposed to we see it initially in the chart of dharmas, you know, where we have different categories of dharmas. There's mind, mental factors, matter, non-associated formations. And in that chart, the first split, the first sort of division in the tree of explaining the taxonomy of dharmas in reality, so to speak, is that there's compounded phenomena, created phenomena, those are like translation of the same word, samskrita dharmas. And there's asamskrita dharmas, not compounded, not created. And that includes nirvana and nirodha samapatti, the cessation trance. If you remember, and then there's two types of that. There's cessation by natural means and cessation by analysis. Ring any bells? Let's see. So then on the bottom of that, page 181 on the left-hand side, they add the following two additional contemplative practices. Contemplating the three meanings, which refers to the sequential contemplation on the true meaning of skandhas, ayatanas, and dhatus. So we see this interesting focus of emphasis on those three categories. Those three ways of categorizing phenomena as being the really important, most important thing to focus our understanding on. So therefore, later they become known as the three skills.
And, this is the meaning too. What was that about?
On the three meanings.
Yeah.
So the idea is, what is the meaning of saying that all phenomena are comprised of skandhas, are heaps. You know, so the meaning of that is that all phenomena are made up of parts and parts and parts. And so there's no partless particle. There's no agent. There's no unitary self. That's, you know, it's basically three different systems to understand selflessness. And then skillfulness with regard to the seven abodes, which is an examination of the five aggregates as they are from seven different perspectives, and he lists those perspectives. On the bottom of that page on the right, to ensure success in meditation, one must purify one's body and mind in three ways. Physical withdrawal. So here we have the standard traditional list of what are the preparations for genuine meditation practice, really rigorous meditation practice, i.e. retreat. If you're going to do retreat, you know, later this becomes a description of what do we do for a retreat practice.
Get a good mixtape.
Physical withdrawal or distancing by dissociating from evil friends and cutting off unfavorable conditions. And mental withdrawal by eradicating unskillful thoughts and turning off your email and your iPhone. Practicing contentment and having few desires. Concentrating your desires on just a few of them, right? But it seems to be okay to still have a few. What would you, like, you get
food,
to pick three?
Food,
sleep. You get to pick three desires.
But
and food are the two main ones.
But
what's the third one?
But these here, these people here, they don't
shelter.
They don't sleep that much. They really don't.
All right, food,
they're like 4 hours a night. These Theravadan monks, and
that's
they think
right.
That's plenty.
That's right, 4 hours a night is standard.
Cheers.
And yeah, their last meal is at noon. I think one of the desires is more dharma.
When they talk about purifying one's body, they mean that in a pretty straightforward and not mystical sense, right?
Yeah.
Which means like
sex,
like a renunciation aspect,
yeah.
Like not desiring food or sex or whatever.
Yeah, no gluttony.
Bathing.
Well, cleanliness, personal cleanliness. You know, I don't know how much they bathe. they bathe a lot more than Tibetans, though. These are in India. It's very hot in India, and there's access to water. And, you know, it's not free.
Tibet, it's 30 below outside. You're lucky you get a sponge bath once a month.
Abiding in the four noble lineages. Called this because the noble ones are begotten from them, which are non-greed, so those, you know, not being greedy, being content, non-greed in nature. They are contentment with clothing, food, bed, and seat. So being content with, you know, modest clothing and so forth, and delight in the abandonment of defilement. Then we have the different stages of the path, a little chart outlining the different stages of the path. So here we have seven stages of preparatory effort in the verbiage before the chart. Can we turn the fan off? Is it okay? Thanks. You turn the fan out, Errol. Big noisy thing. What?
You hear something out there?
Oh.
Say what?
Say what?
So the seven stages of preparatory effort. Here you see the seven prayogas, so that's the seven stages of preparatory effort. Prayoga, preparatory activities. The first three are moksha bhagyas. And so let's turn to our little cheat sheet that a friend of mine named Stephanie Griffiths created for us. Thank you, Stephanie.
Okay, Stephanie.
Well, let's see. Wow. Moksha Vigya, activities conducive to liberation, right? The first one is shamatha, and then 2 and 3 are vipassana. Okay, so what are those practices that are vipassana individually? It's hard to read these without light. Smriti upasthanas, right? So the foundations of mindfulness in Sanskrit. Individually, collectively, this idea of looking one by one at the body, feelings, and so forth, and then looking at them as a group. And the idea is that we start with the one by one and understand the individual specific experiences that we encounter of mind and body and feelings. And then we using logical reasoning, we extend the conclusions that we come to about those individual specific experiences to all occurrences of phenomena within the similar class. And there's a whole system for figuring out what phenomena are of a similar class and how that extension happens. And they call that the pervasion. So first you focus specifically on understanding impermanence. And then you say, well, that's the same reasoning or experience that I had about the impermanence of feeling, of a particular instant of feeling, pervades or extends to all feelings of all time periods and all types. And then the next four are nirvedic ideas. Activities conducive to, what is it, penetration?
Conducive to the arising of outflow-free knowledge.
Outflow-free knowledge, cool. Nirveda. So Veda is the path, sort of the past version of knowledge. And Nir is like a separation, knowledge which is separated. Understanding which separates. And those are four kushala mula, root virtues, virtuous roots, and those are the stages of the second path, right? Ushmagata is the warming heat. Murdan is the peak, and then kshanti is patient acceptance or receptivities, and Laukika Agra Dharma is the highest worldly dharmas. Laukika is of the world. Loka is world, and then Laukika is of the world. And then we have the four fruits, the stages of accomplishment. And so so this is the main scheme that then the rest of the article describes in great detail. The first stage of accomplishment is stream entry, shrota pati. So pati, entering into accomplishment or stabilizing within, and shrota is a stream or a river. Sakradagamin is a once returner. The idea that you would be reborn one more time. And then anagaman is non-returner. And then the fourth is arhat. And those are the four stages of achievement or fruit, accomplishment in this Theravadin system of the path. And they map those to the five paths. We saw paths 1 and 2 in the 7 preparatory stages. And then we have the first path in the fruit section. The result section is the darshana marga. Marga is path, Sanskrit for path, and darshana is seeing, the path of seeing or vision. You may have heard, like, when you go to see your Hindu guru, you go for darshan. Anyone ever hear that? Darshana, the guru? And then we have Bhavana Marga, path of contemplation or cultivation, and then Ashaiksha, no more learning, no more training.
Ashaiksha.
And each of them has a Pratipanaka, which is, let's see, our cheat sheet says Pratipanaka, path of the candidate. So you become one that is running for that office, that result, and then you get voted in and you have the fruit, the power.
So they're just dividing it to, they say, first you're a candidate, then you become the thing.
Yeah, you sort of approach it.
Like all the other things, so like the approach. And
The approach and the actual thing. Like you saw that in the 16 instance there, for each group of eight pairs, there's an approach and then an actual understanding or achievement of it. And here we have this description of the English of those two main types of path, moksha bhagya and nirveda. Okay.
Some of these things are like, they must experience them. Like when they say it's like the obstructions removed, like they must feel that. Like they must feel something opening, and then they're like, and then you enter through. And they must feel that there must be some kind of effort through some.
Yeah, it's clearly based on experience.
Like
system.
It feels so experiential, because otherwise it seems so like ridiculously dogmatic.
Yeah, and like how many angels on a pinhead.
That's what I like. I wanted to say with this word at the end of the course about reading the same, in a way, dumb progression over and over and over. Is sometimes someone phrases it differently, and you get this feel for it being done.
Right, for it actually being an experiential thing.
Like an
people
experience.
Describe it from their point of view.
And not like a dry,
right.
Like 16 is 32 and 32 is. Anyway, that's what that reminded me of.
Yeah, so people experiencing it differently and then categorize, coming up with ways of describing it to other people by having some terminology or categorizations of them. And then you see the differences, the different disputes. You list like different views of different schools that are sometimes dramatically different.
Well, like 16 moments of path of seeing.
Right.
Like some people may, yeah.
Some people say they happen all at the same time, and some people say they sequentially. That's the weirdest little argument. How fast are those moments, anyway?
Well, how are two enlightenments going to be the same anyway?
Yeah.
Isn't there an American arhat who wrote a book?
He claims to be an arhat, doesn't he?
Yeah.
But did you guys see him? Did you go see him in Brooklyn one night?
No, I didn't see him, but he was here. I thought he came to Shambhala or something.
Did he? I don't know about that.
A few years ago, but
he wrote this book called The Unusually Hardcore.
It's free. You can download it for free. Google it.
And he claims to have achieved all these things.
Yeah.
It was unclear if he said he's an arhat or like just like one of these stages of the fruit.
I had the feeling he was claiming arhat.
Yeah.
I never read his book, though. Huh?
There is no fight, though. If you say you're an arhat, then you are definitely not, because...
The fight club.
You didn't say it if you were.
Those who know don't say, and those who say don't know.
Fight club.
We should invite him to the class.
Yeah, wouldn't it be cool? We need an arm.
Like challenge him to debate?
Yeah. He would just say, well, my experience was. Shamatha Vipassana. On the next page, which would be page number 182, I think. No, 84. Above emphasis on the critical importance of the initial phases of activities which cultivate or lead towards deliverance or liberation. Spells out the great significance of tranquility and insight, of which the moksha bhagya is comprised. The practitioner begins with the two shamatha practices of contemplation on the impure, mentioning the two as if this is sort of standard or common understanding that the main shamatha practices are these two. Contemplation on the impure, meaning the body as being impure and thereby developing renunciation of fixation on sense desire, and also eliminating fixation on food, comfort of clothing and bed, and sleep by meditation on the impurities. And then secondly, mindfulness of breathing as being the main practice for shamatha. And these constitute the entrance into the spiritual cultivation proper. The former practice is the contemplation on the progressive deterioration of the body, so using the nine stages of the cemetery contemplation as the focus, and has the counteraction of greed as its aim. The latter comprises six aspects. And this is this odd little list of six stages or activities in shamatha practice that one goes through. That appears in Abhidhamma Kosha and in the Shravaka Bhumi by Vasubandhu's brother Asanga, and gets lost in the Tibetan tradition. Tibetan tradition, for some reason, like, doesn't pick up on these six. Sort of glosses over them in some way. But they appear in the Chinese tradition of meditational cultivation in the so-called meditation school, and on a limited extent in the Theravada tradition. Counting the breaths, and then following the breaths without having to count them, and then fixing one's attention in one place, and then observing the mind. And traditionally the main thing that was observed is the difference between mind and matter. So that as you focus on breathing, what part of that experience is mind and what part is matter? And where does that division happen? And that becomes a jumping off point for insight practice. So like when you move your arm, as I just did, you know, at what point does the mental intention turn into the physical act? And so in other words, being able to see the working of, you know, your experience, internal experience, that clearly and with that much speed or precision, that you're able to see very small, quick movements of our mind-body organism. You know, so doing it by initially noting, you know, moving, naming each thing as you're doing it, gradually being able to see where does the mental intention to move then result in a physical movement. That's their main beginning practice after having achieved stability by fixing, concentrating, and then modifying negative behavior and then purifying negative behavior. The Mahavibhasha Shastra calls these two meditational practices the two gateways of immortality, nirvana. And in the Chinese commentary, he's talking about these major meditation texts by this gentleman named Shi Yi that he states there. The tranquility meditations are often collectively spoken of, the fivefold mental stilling, which I believe is like is the six without the purifying, something like that. Anyway, In the next paragraph in the middle there, it says, at one place in this text, it is stressed that meditators rely mostly on the contemplation of the impurities as the gateway for entering into the noble path. So it serves this dual purpose of refining the attention, strengthening the attention, as well as producing a renunciation so that we give up fixations on the eight worldly dharmas and instead focus on dharma practice. There, this contemplation is discussed at very great length and is shown how immediately after completing this contemplation, the meditator can now sail into Vipassana practice of the mindfulness of the body. It's very interesting that there's an implication that mindfulness of breathing is shamatha, and then the four foundations of mindfulness are Vipassana. This is into the Vipassana practice of mindfulness of the body, etc. So those are viewed in the early tradition, the four foundations are viewed as Vipassana practice. And mindfulness of breathing, that practice per se is viewed as shamatha. Side of the page, the first full paragraph.
Should we get the refreshments?
Oh, we actually have marijuana? I mean, alcohol?
No, just alcohol.
Sure, yeah, for sure.
All right.
Might fall asleep, all of us, but let's go for it. I mean, as we talk about cultivating meditation on purity and renunciation, we should. Consume impurities, desecrate our body, which is the temple.
You know that story? Someone asked Trungpa Rinpoche how he can defile the temple of the body by smoking cigarettes. And he says,
"Well, that got a very big temple."
I think there's different versions of
that. You tell that story a little differently.
Yeah, when people come back in, I'll tell a different version.
Maybe I'm misremembering.
No, not necessarily.
So, with classes and
the Pete goes all out. What a guy. Okay, let's see. What are we going to make you through here tonight?
You know, I actually did the last reading, there's another reading after this, and I actually did that as like a palate cleanser up again, because it wasn't a sign that it was tradition.
How did you like it? What, was it helpful? Or?
It was helpful. There were some good parts of it.
Yeah, maybe we'll shift to that. We'll try to, at a certain point, I'll shift to that, because he gives a nice way of sort of simplifying the different obscurations and where they are overcome, right? Yeah, let's do that. That's a good thing. That's a good idea.
Should we bring some sort of plates in, or we...
Napkins.
Napkins? Okay, do we have napkins?
You guys would fall out here, man.
Rob's sitting there?
A lot of beer.
Yeah,
Rob's
sitting
there.
That's his glass.
Wow!
Did you bring
it? I have
18 beers?
That's she like, brought an extra...
That's like 5 beers per person. You guys ready?
You have as much as you want, and then we get to...
Which I only bought 2, but.
Did you have to fight over the leftovers?
She had like an extra one. Wow.
Chocolate. Wow. Oh, we got plenty of chocolate.
Yeah.
Got chocolate.
This has got ginger, this has got almonds and salt, and this has got mint.
Here are napkins.
All right.
raspberries are awesome. Good.
Okay, guys. Well.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, Tom. Here, pass that around.
Dark.
Oh, can I get a Peroni?
Peroni.
Try one of these. What are those? Ginger, you said?
There's ginger.
The little ginger balls.
Oh.
Try just a cake.
Yeah, whatever. I mean,
anybody else want a napkin?
Or I guess we have glasses.
We do have glasses.
Thank you.
I don't know what to do. Just
Ooh, raspberries.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Chocolate
cow illusion.
Chocolate and beer.
My German grandfather was a big fan of that combination.
Yeah, it's supposed to be like samsara, like stacking raspberries.
Wow.
Oh, you can get two, but you can't really get three.
Oh, now I have to try.
Yeah, I forget where that comes from. Someone said it.
Yeah, just.
Thank you, everyone.
We got lager, Peroni, which I'm sure is a lager. Pilsner,
yeah.
Probably.
Oh,
the dark one.
I think
Guinness.
It's a lager. Italian lager.
Of course.
Given that we've got some quantity.
Yeah. Rob, you're good.
Good.
Cheers.
Let's start this one over here.
Cheers. One.
Thank you.
Three jewels.
Thank you. What kind of chocolates do we got?
Ginger.
Let me have that one.
Almond and
sea salt. And something else. Flavored raspberries. It's maybe just
chocolate.
It's like the new thing, the gourmet chocolate. Years ago, you'd be like, what's that? What is this stuff? It's gotta have it.
So talking about purifying the body, somebody brought up a story about Trungpa Rinpoche. Apparently, early on in his time here in the United States, he was teaching up in the Rocky Mountains at a place called Allen Park that had an open-air pavilion. So that there was no sides to the, you know, like a round roof and no sides. And it was all a lot of hippies in the audience. It was like a place where people would camp out a lot, so it attracted like all these people different walks of life, so to speak. Rinpoche was there drinking alcohol and smoking cigarettes while he was talking. And during the Q&A, this one gentleman stood up, no shirt, long hair, beard, and said, how can you be desecrating your body? Your body is a temple.
He turned out a Hallmark card. Right?
Yeah, that chocolate is awesome. I don't know which that is. The mint, I think.
Mint.
So you should pass those around. Get them away from me.
Yeah, what about the punchline?
So, as he was saying that, a dog walked into the pavilion. Because it was open air, you know, the dog just starts walking, meandering in between Rinpoche and the audience. Rinpoche's up on a little stage, and there's this dog walks by the stage, slowly. And Rinpoche, while the guy is asking the question, or after it, leans over the dog and starts barking at the dog.
What?
And then he stops and he looks up at the guy and says, the whole world is my body.
Oh. Wow.
The whole world is my body.
Pretty good line, huh?
Pretty what?
Pretty good line.
Yeah. Just.
Pretty good comeback.
Were
you at that teacher?
No. John Baker told me.
He was at John Baker.
Yeah.
The whole world is my body.
Yeah, John was there like all the time for the very early period. It's these huge number of amazing stories.
These days it all being videotaped. Just if you would come like 20 years later,
yeah,
all of it would be like on YouTube right now.
Yeah, some of there's a little bit videotaped. They showed us a couple of really old videos at this retreat we're at in Maine.
Yeah, they showed Carmel Chilling every time. The last times I've known it, Carmel Chilling, they showed this one from New York, where they had multiple cameras, and so you see the audience reaction. Mm-hmm. And the audience is going like.
But I think that's a later one. Like, do you remember what Rinpoche's wearing?
Wearing a suit.
Yeah, see, that's much later. You didn't start wearing suits till late.
And all the people in the audiences are wearing suits, too.
Right.
You know, but they've got like 70s, you know, Saturday Night Live haircuts.
Yes. So that, I think it's like 78 or 9 or something, or even 82 or something.
But it's at some theater, and, you know, this one woman got mugged, and she wanted to know, you know.
What should she do? Should he kill again?
Somebody shows up with a gun.
Okay, so on the right-hand side of the page, and this is the same page, where are we? 184. Having achieved tranquility, Sharma to the practitioner then proceeds to the practice of insight, comprising the fourfold application of mindfulness and body, sensation, ideation, and dharmas. This is done in two ways. First, one contemplates the specific characteristics of each of the four. The body is impure, sensations are unsatisfactory, i.e. suffering. Ideations, or the mind, is impermanent, and all dharmas are without a self. Which is a very interesting enumeration, listing the way that we use the four foundations of mindfulness. The mindfulness of mind is to understand the impermanence of the mind. Whereas we usually think that there's an awareness that's unchanging behind it all. The idea is to explore that and see that that sense of awareness changes. And you can't really find anything unchanging in your awareness. Or can you?
And it's unchanging. That it's changing is unchanging.
that reifies it though.
Unchangingly changing.
But I mean, isn't that the purpose of Dzogchen and Maha Mudra, is to sort of see the Rigpa aspect of the nature of your own mind? That part is unchanging.
But you have to see it without seeing it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Or to experience it.
So it's tricky, you know, it's like easy to start to fixate on as if there's a self.
Right, but what we're really looking at is the place where that self is manufactured.
Yeah, the source of dharma, the source of samsara.
Yeah, but that place is anonymous.
Can't find it.
It's also, well, you can't, there's nothing to see other than the luminosity or the clarity.
Can you see that?
No. Not as a thing.
If it's not a thing, how can you see it?
Exactly.
It's a concept.
It's not a concept either.
No. It's just like you just see its shadow. Is that the idea?
It's just a mental experience.
Where is the?
Exactly. Can you draw a picture of it?
Next one contemplates collectively all four as equally impure, unsatisfactory, impermanent, and without a self. On the next page, 185, on the top. According to the Sarvastivada, samadhi and prajna necessarily coexist at two of the 10 universal thought concomitants. So the idea is that those things exist, concentration samadhi and prajna occur in every moment of mind, omnipresent mental factors. However, there's two types of practitioners that can be distinguished from the point of view of their emphasis on one or the other of these activities. Those who mostly cultivate the provisions of shamatha are those who, at the stage of preparatory effort, always delight in solitude and shun noise. They see the faults of socializing and constantly dwell in quiet places. When they enter into the noble path, they are called the shamatha type of practitioner, and the other are the vipassana type of practitioner. Abhidharma, in the next paragraph, the second line, Abhidharma masters debate on how many of the six aspects of mindfulness of breathing come under shamatha or vipassana. And this refers to counting, following, fixing, and so forth. Some say the first three are shamatha, so if you turn back the page, the six were counting, following, fixing. So some say those first three are shamatha, and then observing, modifying, and purifying are vipassana.
Others are the opposite.
Others, the compilers of the NVS remark that there's no fixed rule here. All may come under shamatha, or all may come under vipassana.
What's meant by modifying?
Modifies change behavior?
And so you
transform? No, it's really like change your awareness. It shifts from the breath. Mm-hmm. That's the interesting thing that appears to come out of it, from the very little that I've been able to see from what's written about it, is that it shifts from the focus shifts from the breath to the mind. And so then ultimately we're observing the mind in the fourth one, and modifying and purifying the mind, as opposed to purifying or modifying the breath.
I thought it was nice the way at the top of the page and the previous page it just acknowledges, oh, well, the shamatha and vipassana really are always inseparable, even though we always teach first shamatha and then vipassana.
Yeah, because that was a nice point.
The Vijayara was always being on that and kind of merging them very early on, and we always felt, oh, that's so sophisticated. And then here the Savad said, oh, the Savad's known, you know, they're always really kind of inseparable. Every thought there exists both shamatha and vipassana.
Let's see, on the right-hand side of the page, he alludes to this issue of how much shamatha, how far one has to go in the cultivation of the absorptions in order to experience vipassana, which is one of the other big debates. And then
so
I think, let's
say yes to the jhanas in order to experience true vipassana.
Right.
And that's where the jhanas disagree, right?
And many others. Yeah. So let's shift to the last reading in the book that sort of sums up this whole system of what obstructions are overcome at one point, which is on page 200. On the right-hand side of the page, the qualities of elimination. The ultimate qualities of elimination are attained when the emotional, klesha, and cognitive jnaya, or jnana, obscurations are overcome by the two kinds of wisdom generated on the path of seeing and meditation. There's the wisdom of the path of seeing and the wisdom of the path of meditation. The 112 obscurations eliminated on the path of seeing. So there's different categories of obscurations, and he quotes from the Abhidharma Samachaya, and then he comments on that on page 201. He says 112 obscurations are eliminated by seeing. 10 of these are root, and of these, 5 are views and 5 are not views. So he's talking about the 6 root kleshas in the list of mental factors: passion, aggression, stubbornness, pride, and doubt. And then there's wrong view, and there's 5 types of wrong view. And when you expand the 5 types of wrong view, you get this list of 10 root obstructions. those that are not views, i.e. the five emotions of attachment, anger, pride, confusion, and doubt, those that are views or opinions are the view, the transitory composite, the belief in an I, the view of extremes, nihilism and eternalism, wrong views, thinking that karma does not exist, the view of doctrinal superiority, thinking that one theory or view is supreme to all others, and the view of ethical superiority, thinking that one practice is supreme to all other practices. In the realm of desire, these 10 factors, so there are three realms, desire, form, and formless. In the realm of desire, these 10 factors are detrimental to each of the four truths, thus making 40. In the form and formless realms, there's no anger. So you have 9 factors for each of the four truths. It's 36 each. It's 72 plus the 40 is 112.
Why is that one eliminated and not the other ones? What is specific about that?
In order to achieve the absorption states that are the basis for the form and formless realms, you have to eliminate aggression, anger.
But you can still have jealousy and pride. I mean,
yeah, subtle.
Jealousy that you're not in the higher one, pride that you've accomplished what you've accomplished.
Exactly.
But anger must be like such like.
Yeah.
You have to.
It makes the mind move too much.
Yeah.
Right. Passion, attachment for the next higher, the next greater experience, or attachment for the current state of bliss that one achieves in those absorptions. So those do exist in a subtle sense in those realms. How the obscurations fight against the understanding of the four truths. The three views, and the two non-views that run counter to an understanding of the four truths act in the following way. So the three and the two make five, and we went through the list of five views in the last paragraph, and he's saying that those split into two types. There's three of them are views and two are not really views, even though they call them the five views. Two of them are not views.
Two non-views.
Non-views. Non-views.
Non-views.
The view of the transitory composite asserts the four truths in terms of I and mine. The view of extremes is the belief that this self is either permanent or annihilated at death. Wrong view simply denies the law of karma. Non-view of ignorance will simply not know what the four truths signify, while doubts will hesitate over them and question their veracity. All these factors jeopardize a proper understanding of the four truths, and because they do so, unless prevented, they are regarded as directly running counter to that. Let's see. Let's skip up these. Anger in the next paragraph is generally detrimental on account of its conditioning power. In addition to holding erroneous views, people may well be irritated when others disagree with them. When this happens, their anger is not, of course, directed at the four truths or their own view. Consequently, anger is regarded as inimical to the four truths only by its conditioning power. In other words, by the negative effect it has on the general situation and the process of understanding, is the footnote at the bottom.
Closes the mind.
Yes.
It turns the mind away from the four truths.
Yep.
That's why it's bad.
Yep.
So otherwise you should just always be
angry.
No. Otherwise you should just be seeing the four truths.
All the time.
That's the main
takeaway, right, from this whole thing. Is that you should be constantly seeing the four truths, right? And then the other article said that as you progress in the four stages of the path of preparation, the focus on the four truths gets narrowed, right? And, oh, I forgot to do that. It's helpful to look at the 16 aspects of the four truths, right?
Yeah.
Which are on... Gives a list.
I got a little lost about whether the 16 moments related to the 16 aspects, or they're related to other 16.
they relate to the 16 aspects, but there's different ways of looking at how many how those aspects like clump together. There were two different versions.
Okay.
So the first 15 of the 16 moments. Oh, he doesn't give us English.
Where are we?
On 191.
191.
Oh, damn. There was somewhere else he gave the English.
What do you have, Mr.
Here we go. On the top of, 192 on the right hand side.
Yeah.
Oppression. So the first four are related to suffering. Oppression, meaning sort of suffering being compounded is suffering, torment is suffering, and change is suffering. All those pertain to dukkha, sacca. Sacca being truth in Pali. Accumulation is the first type of origination. Origin of suffering, source, connection, and obstruction. All those pertain to the origination of suffering, the truth of origin. Exit, separation, being uncompounded, and immortality, or unchanging, usually it's translated, pertain to Nirodha, cessation, truth of cessation, and then truth of the path is leading out, cause, seeing, and dominance. Dominant condition, dominant situation. And he gives this analogy of the lamp. The lamp's burning the wick, knowledge that comprehends dukkha, suffering. The lamp dispelling darkness, knowledge abandoning the causation of suffering, the cause. Lamp revealing the light, knowledge developing the path, cessation. Is the path developing the path, revealing light, and then lamp consuming the oil, burning up the fuel of samsara, is the knowledge achieving Nirodha cessation.
That's the four truths.
That's the four truths, right.
Well, I know why it is. It's because the list of the moments on page 191 has different words on it than that list we just read, than these 16 aspects. It doesn't reuse those same terms. So that's why...
Isn't it in Sanskrit?
It doesn't reuse the Palana, Sankata, Santapa. It just says different names. Four relating to dukkha, if they say different things, so it's hard to tell. They may actually...
I think it's interesting how
they
do come back to like admitting to a little bit of sudden enlightenment at
the
16th stages.
Moment.
Yeah. Well, at various stages, it seems like after four, there's a
right.
And then there's another blossoming, and then
So. But you have to, so you have to do a lot of preparation, and then you get to that point, and boom.
Then there's a
And
then
there's
a reveal.
A sudden, right. A sudden breakthrough. Okay, so then 414. You have your calculators. I've got you all nicely drunk, so now we're going to do some higher math. We'll do some higher math. Okay, so we're on page 202 of the source book. There are six root obscurations eliminated by the path of meditation. Attachment, anger, pride, ignorance, and the view of the transitory composite. And the view of extremes. So which one of the kleshas is missing from this list? I'm on 202, the first full paragraph.
Jealousy.
Doubt. Well, it's just two of the views.
Only two of the views, right.
So it's essentially anger, pride, ignorance, and a part of, and view, but only some of it.
Right. It's interesting, isn't it? Anyway, if these are calculated according to the three realms, as usual, they come to a total of 16. Now, 3 times 6 is 18, right? But the anger doesn't appear in the two higher realms, so you knock off 2, so you're at 16. In this desire realm, 6, while in the others there's no anger, so 5. Alternatively, if this obscurations are categorized according to the levels of mundane existence, there's 6 for desire, 5 in each of the 4 in each of the 4 levels of samadhi in the form realm, so 20 altogether in the form realm, and again 20 again in the formless realms. By adding these together, this comes to 46. 20, 20, 6 is 46. And then we have, according to intensity, each of the 46 can be further broken down into 9 subdivisions. There's weak, medium, and strong, and then each of those has a weak, medium, has 3 grades.
The
weak of the weak, and the strong of the strong.
Oh, that's what that's
the weak
strong
of the
medium, yeah. The weak of the medium, yeah. Medium of the medium.
Once I started reading like weak, weak, and strong, strong, I just started spinning.
Yeah, like, what are they talking about? This must be a mistake. And then in the other article at the end, he talked about how the strong, strong of the antidotes of the understanding uproots the weak, weak of the obscurations, meaning that they're the subtlest of the obscurations are the hardest to uproot, right? And the gross level of the obscurations are the easiest to uproot.
And then there was a colorful analogy of like how you need a strong light,
right?
A little bit of darkness,
yeah, and a weak light,
only a little bit of cleaner to wash out the big stains, but the small stains.
Yeah, that was cool. let's see.
Makes sense.
And so this, what is it? 9 times 46 is a grand total of 414. Moreover, the 5 obscurations, discounting anger, can be categorized according to a system of 9 levels and degrees and 9 degrees. This comes to 405. And together with the 9 degrees of anger, desire realm, we again have 414. So there's 2 ways of coming up to 414.
Is that magical?
They both like come to the same number. And so these, so 112 are eliminated on the path of seeing, and then 414 on the path of meditation, making a total of 526. The magical number. All you have to do is eliminate 526 obscurations.
Wow.
That's right. It takes 3 counts.
At least you have a hard number, you know. Just
yeah, at least you know the exact, you know.
Start, you know.
Let's go.
Yeah, exactly.
So, first of all, we
break it down. Conquer it.
It's all about, yeah, it's all about breaking it down.
Hang it up next to your shrine.
What did I have today?
And then on, let's see, page 203, there's some stuff about the 16 moments. And on the right-hand side, in one of his writings, the Noble Asanga explains the 16 instances as follows. First, at the time of acceptance, patient acceptance of the knowledge of the nature of suffering. So he described in the other articles 2 stages to each of the 16. There's the, or each of the 4 truths, rather. There's the acceptance of it, and then there's the complete understanding of it. Eliminating everything by seeing falls away. At the moment of understanding the nature of suffering, the wisdom antidote arises. Through subsequent acceptance and understanding dawns that the wisdom of accepting and the wisdom of understanding the nature of suffering constitute the ground of the noble path of meditation. Through subsequent understanding, there is the realization that the subsequent acceptance is the ground of the noble path. Acceptance and understanding of the nature of the 4 truths pertain more to the object apprehended, namely the truths themselves. By contrast, subsequent acceptance and subsequent understanding refer to the wisdom, namely the apprehending agent in the inquiry. So there's 2 sets of truths, 4 sets for each of the truths. vaguely interesting. Then finally, on the next and last page of the book, on the left-hand side, how are the obscurations eliminated in the path of meditation? It is said that through familiarity with practice, the antidotes to the these obscurations, which in fact constitute the path of meditation itself, will gradually develop, beginning from the most general, progressing to the most penetrating. As a result, the obscurations will disappear in the same order, starting from the most gross and proceeding to the most subtle. The obscurations eliminated by seeing are imputed misconceptions, whereas the obscurations eliminated by meditation are innate thought patterns. We say that the obscurations eliminated by the path of seeing are eliminated by understanding, by reasoning, and that the obscurations that are eliminated in the path of meditation are eliminated by training the mind, by acclimating oneself to what has been seen, to emptiness, and pervading one's obstructions with that view of emptiness, and gradually wearing away the latent potentials. Imputation refers to the view of the transitory composite, the extreme views of eternalism, and so forth, and they are conceptions imputed newly in each existence under the influence of mistaken theories, people who take up a philosophical position, etc., etc., etc. The next paragraph, the obscurations eliminated by seeing run counter to the nature of the four truths. The obscurations eliminated by meditation run counter to the sense objects, such as form, and so on. Even though the obscuration of strong anger is completely eliminated only on the path of meditation, it's already attenuated by the sun of wisdom on the path of seeing, which withers it like a rotting shoot. That's why it is said that the Aryas are free from such afflictions once they've attained the noble path, even though those afflictions are not fully eliminated until the path of meditation. So the roots are withered, but they haven't uprooted the sort of ramifications of them. And let's see. I think that's it. Yeah, we're good one, bro.
Acquired versus innate?
Acquired versus innate.
Is that what I'm talking about? Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of beer here. We can't leave till it's finished.
No. Take it home.
Thank you for the beer and the chocolate and the raspberries. That was very kind.
Yeah, really. Thank you, Pete.
Me, I just bought a couple of the six packs. I didn't get the chocolate.
Thank you, Pete, Mary Beth, Barbara. Anyone else? Chris, Eric?
Yeah.
Raspberries and chocolate. Those are good. Let me check those guys out again.
Yeah, I have a question about the Venus class.
Yeah.
So I'm just the first one, but I read on the monthly calendar, there's a text, and is that something you can order, or is that something we'll get? Because I couldn't find it.
Devotion and Crazy Wisdom. So next course is on Sadhana Mahamudra.
Ah, it is.
Yeah.
We can get it from Vermont. What's that place in Vermont? The cushion store.
Somebody cushions in Vermont?
Yeah, that's right. Also,
yeah,
get it.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah,
it's
order,
really weird.
The Crazy Wisdom book, yeah?
Yeah, also the center said they'll order a bunch.
Crazy Wisdom.
Okay. And the other thing is, are you going to be doing a source book?
Yes.
Because?
There'll be some selected reading, so I'll send it to you by electricity.
Thank you.
And if you're away, you could get yourself a copy of that from Samadhi Cushions in Vermont.
I'll just store it, yeah. I'm only away once the first week. So.
When does it start?
July 11th. So hopefully that'll be fun, very different from our usual nerdy courses. This will be much more practice-oriented.
Colorful.
More colorful. What's the structure? Like, everyone else seems to know about this. I don't know the damn thing. Is it going to be like a line-by-line analysis if you did in the ocean course?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we have 6 weeks, so it'll be a combination of general topics and line by line. The other one was 10 weeks, so we got to go to every line. This will be just the, mostly the topics and then sort of highlights of the wording. And I'll try to do a little of the practice each class as well.
It's Vajrayana. That's
sound like fun, right?
It's first time. I don't think you've ever
compared,
taught Vajrayana. I mean,
yeah,
not
for a long
this
time.
Yet.
Yeah. Yeah, way back. Yeah, it's fun that the center is up for doing it. Erica's idea. And they said, great. So, thank you very much.
From stormy waves of earth, all days, sickness and death, from the ocean, samsara, may I free all beings, by the confidence of the golden sign of the great beast. May the lotus garden, the radiant wisdom bloom. May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Those balls are really good.
What is it?
It's
dark chocolate and like ginger?
Is that what they are?
Yeah, dark chocolate and ginger.
Really good.
The last piece.